Chapter 42. This to your highness. He laid in the duke's hand a small object in black and silver, which on nearer inspection proved to be the ducal coat of arms. Odo stood gazing fixedly at this mysterious token, which seemed to come as an answer to his inmost thoughts. His heart beat high with confused hopes and fears, and he could hardly control the voice in which he answered, "Colon bid Andrian I come to me." 4.4. The bookseller began by excusing himself for the liberty he had taken. He explained that the Signorina Fulvia Vivaldi, in whose behalf he came, was in urgent need of aid, and had begged him to wait on the Duke as soon as the court had risen from the play. "She is in Pianura, then?" Odo exclaimed. "Since yesterday, your highness. 3 days since she was ordered by the police to leave Milan within 24 hours, and she came at once to Pianura, knowing that my wife and I would gladly receive her. But today we learned that the Holy Office was advised of her presence here, and of the reason of her banishment from Lombardy, and this fresh danger has forced her to implore your highness's protection." Andrian I went on to explain that the publication of her father's book was the immediate cause of Fulvia's persecution. The Origin of Civilization, which had been printed some months previously in Amsterdam, had stirred Italy more profoundly than any book since Beccaria's great work on crime and punishment. The author's historical investigations were but a pretext for the development of his political theories, which were set forth with singular daring and audacity, and supported by all the arguments that his long study of the past commanded. The temperate and judicial tone which he had succeeded in preserving enhanced the effect of his arraignment of church and state, and while his immense erudition commended his work to the learned, its directness of style gave it an immediate popularity with the general reader. It was an age when every book or pamphlet bearing on the great question of personal liberty was eagerly devoured by an insatiable public. And a few weeks after Vivaldi's volume had been smuggled into Italy, it was the talk of every club and coffee house from Calabria to Piedmont. The inevitable result soon followed. The Holy Office got wind of the business, and the book was at once put on the index. In Naples and Bologna it was publicly burned, and in Medina a professor of the university who was found to have a copy in his possession was fined and removed from his chair. In Milan, where the strong liberal faction among the nobility, and the comparative leniency of the Austrian rule, permitted a more unrestrained discussion of political questions, the Origin of Civilization was received with open enthusiasm, and the story of the difficulties that Fulvia had encountered in its publication made her the heroine of the moment. As he had never concealed her devotion to her father's doctrines, and in the first glow of filial pride she may have yielded too openly to the desire to propagate them. Certain it is that she began to be looked on as having shared in the writing of the book, or as being at least an active exponent of its principles. Even in Lombardy it was not well to be too openly associated with the authorship of a condemned book. And Fulvia was suddenly advised by the police that her presence in Milan was no longer acceptable to the government. The news excited great indignation among her friends, and Count Castiglione and several other gentlemen of rank hastened to intervene in her behalf, but the governor declared himself unwilling to take issue with the Holy Office on a doctrinal point, and privately added that it would be well for the Signorina Vivaldi to withdraw from Lombardy before the clergy brought any direct charge against her. To ignore this hint would have been to risk not only her own safety, but that of the gentleman who had befriended her. And Fulvia at once set out for Pianura, the only place in Italy where she could count on friendship and protection. Andrian I and his wife would gladly have given her a home, but on learning that the Holy Office was on her track, as he had refused to compromise them by remaining under their roof, and had insisted that Andrian I should wait on the Duke and obtain a safe conduct for her that very night. Odo listened to this story with an agitation compounded of strangely contradictory sensations. to learn that Fulvia, at the very moment when he had pictured her as separated from him by the happiness and security of her life, was in reality a proscribed wanderer with none but himself to turn to, filled him with a confused sense of happiness. But the discovery that, in his own dominions, the political refugee was not safe from the threats of the Holy Office, excited a different emotion. All these considerations, however, were subordinate to the thought that he must see Fulvia at once. It was impossible to summon her to the palace at that hour, or even to secure her safety till morning, without compromising Andriani by calling attention to the fact that a suspected person was under his roof. And for a moment Odo was at a loss how to detain her in Pianura without seeming to go counter to her wishes. Suddenly he remembered that Gamba was fertile in expedients, and calling in the hunchback, asked what plan he could devise. Gamba, after a moment's reflection, drew a key from his pocket. "May it please your highness," he said, "this unlocks the door of the hunting lodge at Pontesordo. The place has been deserted these many years, because of its bad name, and I have more than once found it a convenient shelter, when I had reasons for wishing to be private. At this season there is no fear of poison from the marshes, and if your highness desires I will see that the lady finds her way there before sunrise." The sun had hardly risen the next morning, when the Duke himself set forth. He rode alone, dressed like one of his own esquires, and gave the word unremarked to the sleepy sentinel at the gate. As it closed behind him, and he set out down the long road that led to the chase, it seemed to him that the morning solitude was thronged with spectral memories. Melancholy and fanciful they flitted before him, now in the guise of Cerveno and Mamola, now of Maria Clementina and himself. Every detail of the scene was interwoven with the fibers of early association, from the far-off years when, as a lonely child on the farm at Pontesordo, he had gazed across the marsh at the mysterious woodlands of the chase, to the later day when, in the deserted hunting lodge, the Duchess had flung her whip at the face in the Venice mirror. He pressed forward impatiently, and presently the lodge rose before him in its grassy solitude. The level sunbeams had not yet penetrated the surrounding palisade of boughs, and the house lay in a chill twilight that seemed an emanation from its moldering walls. As Odo approached, Gamba appeared from the shadow and took his horse, and the next moment he had pushed open the door and stood in Fulvia's presence. She was seated at the farther end of the room, and as she rose to meet him, it chanced that her head, enveloped in its black traveling hood, was relieved for a moment against the tarnished background of the broken mirror. The impression struck a chill to his heart, but it was replaced by a glow of boyish happiness as their eyes met, and he felt her hands in his. For a moment all his thoughts were lost in the mere sense of her nearness. She seemed simply an enveloping atmosphere in which he drew fresh breath, but gradually her outline emerged from this haze of feeling, and he found himself looking at her with the wondering gaze of a stranger. As he had been a girl of 16 when they first met. 12 years had passed since then, and she was now a woman of 28, belonging to a race in which beauty ripens early, and as soon declines. But some happy property of nature, whether the rare mold of her features, or the gift of the spirit that informed them, had held her loveliness intact, preserving the clear lines of youth after its bloom was gone, and making her seem like a lover's memory of herself. So she appeared at first, a bright imponderable presence gliding toward him out of the past. But as her hands lay in his, the warm current of life was renewed between them, and the woman dispossessed the shade. 4.5. Unpublished fragment from Mr. Arthur Young's diary of his travels in Italy in the year 1789. October 1st. Having agreed with a vetturino to carry me to Pianura, set out this morning from Mantua. The country mostly arable, with rows of elm and maple pollard. Dined at Casal Maggiore, in an infamous filthy inn. At dinner was joined by a gentleman who had taken the other seat in the vettura as far as Pianura. We engaged in conversation and I found him a man of lively intelligence and the most polished address. Though dressed in the foreign style, an ab, he spoke English with as much fluency as myself, and but for the philosophical tone of his remarks I had taken him for an ecclesiastic. Altogether a striking, and somewhat perplexing character. Able, keen, intelligent, evidently used to the best company, yet acquainted with the condition of the people, the methods of farming, and other economical subjects such as are seldom thought worthy of attention among Italians of quality. It appeared he was newly from France, where he had been as much struck as myself by the general state of ferment. Though owning that there was much reason for discontent, and that the conduct of the court and ministers was blind, and infatuated beyond belief, he yet declared himself gravely apprehensive of the future, saying that the people knew not what they wanted, and were unwilling to listen to those that might have proved their best advisers. Whether by this, he meant the clergy I know not, though I observed he spoke favorably of that body in France, pointing out that, long before the recent agitations, they had defended the civil rights of the Third Estate, and citing many cases in which the country curates had shown themselves the truest friends of the people. A fact my own observation hath confirmed. I remarked to him that I was surprised to find how little talk there was in Italy of the distracted conditions in France, and this though the country is overrun with French refugees, or émigrés, as they call themselves, who bring with them reports that might well excite the alarm of neighboring governments. He said he had remarked the same indifference, but that this was consonant with the Italian character, which never looked to the morrow, and he added that the mild disposition of the people, and their profound respect for religion, were sufficient assurance against any political excess. To this I could not forbear replying that I could not regard as excesses the just protests of the poor against the unlawful tyranny of the privileged classes, nor forbear to hail with joy the dawn of that light of freedom which hath already shed so sublime an effulgence on the wilds of the New World. The abbate took this in good part, though I could see he was not wholly of my way of thinking. But he declared that in his opinion different races needed different laws, and that the sturdy and temperate American colonists were fitted to enjoy a greater measure of political freedom than the more volatile French and Italians, as though liberty were not destined by the Creator to be equally shared by all mankind. Footnote. I let this passage stand, though the late unhappy events in France have, alas, proved that my friend the abbate was nearer right than myself. June, 1794. In the afternoon through a poor country to Pont d'Ipo, a miserable village on the borders of the duchy, where we lay, not slept, in our clothes, at the worst inn I have yet encountered. Here our luggage was plumbed for Pianura. The impertinence of the petty sovereigns to travelers in Italy is often intolerable, and the customs officers show the utmost insolence in the search for seditious pamphlets and other contraband articles. But here I was agreeably surprised by the courtesy of the officials, and the dispatch with which our luggage was examined. On my remarking this, my companion replied that the Duke of Pianura was a man of liberal views, anxious to encourage foreigners to visit his state, and the last to put petty obstacles in the way of travel. I answered, this was the report I had heard of him, and it was in the hope of learning something more of the reforms he was said to have effected, that I had turned aside to visit the duchy. My companion replied that His Highness had in fact introduced some innovations in the government, but that changes which seemed the most beneficial in one direction often worked mischief in another, so that the wisest ruler was perhaps not he that did the greatest amount of good, but he that was cause of the fewest evils. The second. From Pont d'Ipo to Pianura the most convenient way is by water. But the river Piana being greatly swollen by the late rains, my friend, who seems well acquainted with the country, proposed driving thither. A suggestion I readily accepted, as it gave me a good opportunity to study the roads and farms of the duchy. crossing the Piana, drove near 4 hours over horrible roads across waste land, thinly wooded, without houses or cultivation. On my expressing surprise that the territory of so enlightened a prince would lie thus neglected, the abate said this ill, and was a fief of the see of Pianura, and that the duke was desirous of annexing it to the duchy. I asked if it were true that his highness had given his people a constitution modeled on that of the Duke of Tuscany. He said he had heard the report, but that for his part he must deplore any measure tending to debar the clergy from the possession of land. Seeing my surprise, he explained that, in Italy at least, the religious orders were far better landlords than the great nobles or the petty sovereigns, who, being for the most part absent from their estates, left their peasantry to be pillaged by rapacious middlemen and stewards. An argument I have heard advanced by other travelers, and of myself at frequent occasion to corroborate. On leaving the bishop's domain, remarked an improvement in the roads. Flat land, well irrigated, and divided as usual into small holdings. The pernicious metayer system exists everywhere, but I am told the Duke is opposed to it, though it is upheld, not only by the landed class, but by the numerous economists that write on agriculture from their closets, but would doubtless be sorely puzzled to distinguish a beetroot from a turnip. The third. Set out early to visit Pianura. The city clean and well kept. The Duke has introduced street lamps, such as are used in Turin, and the pavement is remarkably fair and even. Few beggars are to be seen, and the people have a thriving look. Visited the cathedral and baptistery, in the Gothic style, more curious than beautiful. Also the Duke's picture gallery. Learning that the Duchess was to ride out in the afternoon, had the curiosity to walk abroad to see her. A good view of her as she left the palace. Though no longer in her first youth, she is one of the handsomest women I have seen. Remarked a decided likeness to the Queen of France, though the eye and smile are less engaging. The people in the streets received her sullenly, and I am told her debts and disorders are the scandal of the town. She has, of course, her syssisbio, and the Duke is the devoted slave of a learned lady, who is said to exert an unlimited influence over him, and to have done much to better the condition of the people. A new part for a prince's mistress to play. In the evening to the theater, a handsome building, well lit with wax, where Cimarosa's Du Baroni was agreeably sung. The fourth. My Lord Hervey, in Florence, having favored me with a letter to Count Tresker, the Duke's Prime Minister, I waited on that gentleman yesterday. His Excellency received me politely, and assured me that he knew me by reputation, and would do all he could to put me in the way of investigating the agricultural conditions of the duchy. Contrary to the Italian custom, he invited me to dine with him the next day. As a rule, these great nobles do not open their doors to foreigners, however well recommended. Visited, by appointment, the press of the celebrated Andreoni, who was banished during the late Duke's reign for suspected liberal tendencies, but is now restored to favor and placed at the head of the royal topography. Signor Andreoni received me with every mark of esteem, and after having shown me some of the finest examples of his work such as the Pindar, the Lucretius and the Dante, accompanied me to a neighboring coffee house, where I was introduced to several lovers of agriculture. Here I learned some particulars of the Duke's attempted reforms. He has undertaken the work of draining the vast marsh of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.